transformer that was designed for U.S. service, 60 hertz, and I put in 50 hertz, the core will most likely saturate, and a saturated core runs hot. So, simultaneously, if I took that 60-cycle transformer in the United States, which is wound for 120 volts primary, and I put 240 volts primary, again, I'm going to saturate it. So any piece of iron with any kind of a winding on it, if you go lower in frequency or higher in voltage, you are subject to saturating that iron. A high VISWR on a iron type balance will be, in many cases, subjecting it to a higher voltage. You put a higher voltage or a lower frequency into a piece of iron, and if that piece of iron saturates, it draws ridiculous amounts of current on the positive and negative half cycles during that saturation and can dissipate power like crazy. The iron itself, Wesley recognized, the iron itself can really get hot, the wire can get hot, the whole thing can turn into smoke and flames. That's one case where smoke and flames are real. N2XJN, go ahead with your comment, K2LIW.
The logic of yours is proper, but the case that you compare to is improper. That would be in the ideal situation. The difference is mostly 17%. That's what roughly it is. But you didn't mention that how that transformer metal part is built. It has a plate. They're actually with the isolation sheet on it. In the old time, they use a mica for it. Mica, the mineral. Then they start to use the paint. Then they start to use the kshem. I don't know how to translate kshem. Whatever. So when you change the frequency to the same plate, but you have a proper isolation between the plates of the carcass of the transformer, you will not have that factor visible. You will not even see that. Back to you.
Okay, Wesley, you're discussing another factor, which is called eddy current. If the individual sheets of the EI lamination of a 60-cycle transformer, if the individual sheets are not isolated from each other with mica, paper, paint, iridite, whatever, if the individual sheets are not isolated from each other, as you go up in frequency, you get eddy currents. As you go down in frequency, I don't care how well isolated they are, you go down low enough in frequency, or you go high enough in voltage, you will again saturate the iron. Iron magnetic saturation is a little bit different than eddy currents. Both create heat by different mechanism. So higher frequency laminations not being isolated, that's the eddy current effect. And I don't think these guys are running into eddy current effect, because the balans we're talking about are made out of ferrite. The ferrite is very fine grains of iron in some kind of a plastic holding mechanism, some kind of a epoxy-like substance. So in the case of ferrite, we're not going higher in frequency in creating heating. We're going lower in frequency and creating saturation, or we're going higher in voltage in creating saturation.
Comment.
I think eddy currents and the saturation are fairly different phenomena. Back to you for another comment, Wesley.
Well, you're talking about something, but you didn't mention two factors. It's the power and it's the size. That means how many square meters, centimeters, millimeters, whatever, is applied to the certain power of the changes of parameters. Back to you.
I'm going to agree with you on that one. Every transformer has a certain amount of cross-sectional area of the iron. As such, depending on the number of turns on the primary winding of a transformer, there is a certain amount of volts, ampere turns, watts, is a limit. Once you know the square centimeters of the cross-sectional area of the iron, you could say there's a certain number of watts you cannot go above without saturating the iron. But again, that's transformer theory, a little bit different than the ferrite Grunella. The Grunella type of impedance matching balloning device is made for a particular frequency. Don't go lower in that frequency. It's made for a particular voltage. That voltage happens to be a certain power level and a certain standing wave ratio level. You take a Grunella ballon, you go low enough in frequency, you will saturate it and burn it up. You go high enough in power, which really is high enough in voltage, you'll burn it up by saturation. Even if you're at the right frequency and the right power level, if you go high enough in standing wave ratio, you're forcing it to operate at high voltage, you will again saturate the iron, and you'll burn it up.
Something silly to say.
Go right ahead.
Hey Siri, take two Brunella balloons and try to play with them. Take three of them, take four of them. Maneuver or just change the size of that.
Okay, it's not because it's a Grunella ballon that you're saturating it. You're saturating it because of the amount of iron that's there in your Grunella ballon. If you've got a Grunella ballon that's designed for 100 watts, and it's designed for a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio, and you feed 200 watts into it, you could be in trouble. You feed 50 watts into it, even though it's designed for 100, and you make the standing wave ratio high enough, you're in trouble. Redesign the Grunella ballon with a bigger piece of ferrite, and you're out of trouble. So it'll stop it from saturating. So just like with a power transformer, there is a wattage, voltage, frequency limit. Same thing with ferrite. There is a wattage, frequency, standing wave ratio limit for that size of iron. I wonder if you see it approximately that way, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Exactly. I was going to explain that, but you guys are just getting off the beaten path, so getting calls already. All right, let me slow this down a little bit. There are the two ballons that we're talking about Ruthroth, and we're talking about Grunella. I should say we're talking about Grunella, which is basically considered a current ballon. There is also another ballon known as the Ruthroth ballon, which is basically a voltage ballon. However, they both basically, except for a number of different idiosyncrasies, both have one thing in common. They can both be 4-to-1 ballons. Now, the problem is what Dick was bringing up is the permeability of the cores. They do specify the cores by permeability, and you can't just go all over the place. When you get the permeabilities of ferrite especially, and you see some of them actually rated below, I think, about 300, the ballons then show very high inefficiencies. And when you have something inefficient, you know you're going to have heat. And this is the problem, the mix. Some of the mixes are not of the best quality, because I'll tell you, let me let it drop what's happening. I have seen that some of them are, I won't mention names of tuners, but they are looking for bargains, basically. And the mix is not what they call, the permeability of the mix is not sufficient. So that now, they will rate the tuner at a kilowatt, you could run half that power and that ballon is getting pretty goddamn hot. And you know you do that for a period of time, especially if you get long-winded like I am, all of a sudden you're going to see smoke come out of that tuner, Dick. Over.
Yeah, you're getting into one of the factors I mentioned in the beginning. Is the manufacturer telling you the truth, number one. Number two, are you using it at the right frequency or higher? Number three, are you using it at the right power level or lower? Number four, are you using it at the right standing wave ratio or lower? You go to two higher standing wave ratio, two lower frequency, two higher power, or choose a manufacturer that lies enough. Any one of those four factors, you go on the wrong side of that factor, you're going to get smoke and flames. There are ways of making a balun work at higher power, higher visoir, lower frequency. Sometimes it's a bigger piece of iron of higher permeability or higher flux capability before it saturates. There are other ways of constructing a balun. And I'm a little bit amazed at the fact that a kind of balun is called Grinnella. Let me drop. That strikes me okay, but the word Ruff-Ruff, I'm a little bit amazed by that, because Ruff-Ruff wrote this article about 20 different kinds of balluns. To call one of those a Ruff-Ruff, I'm a little bit troubled by that. Maybe a manufacturer has done it. I don't think Mr. Ruff-Ruff would agree with that, because he is repeating in his original 1968 article in Microwave Theory and Techniques, he's repeating, he's gathering from a whole lot of different sources, many, many balluns, and putting them all in one individual article. His was a compendium article, in my opinion, and he wasn't claiming to be inventing those balluns that were in that article. But I got to go back and reread the article. I may have remembered it incorrectly, but I don't remember him claiming to have invented a particular ballon. He was giving you a compendium article of all the currently used balluns. He was sucking them in from various obscure sources that were well-kept secrets in the RF world, and he put it all together in one article. But understanding how a balun works is not easy. Understanding how to stop it from saturating and burning up, that's somewhat understandable. And there are ways of reconstructing a balun. The only reason you use ferrite is because it's got a higher permeability than air, and it allows you to make the balun more compact. If you're willing to make the balun large enough, in some cases, making it out of coils of coax cable will be a larger structure, but it can tolerate a much higher power level and do the operation you desire. So there are ways you could redesign a balun that's in your antenna tuner and get around this problem if you're smart enough. I didn't say it's easy. I'm just telling you it's possible. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WA2VDH with a question.
WA2VDH, Victor Delta Hotel. Start with your name and go right ahead, sir.
Okay, thank you, Dick. My question, my name is, handle is John. Question is about the trade-off between power and SWR. Does this trade-off in the way that you would have to figure out what is the voltage for a certain SWR, and then as the SWR went up, you'd have to make sure you didn't exceed that voltage? Exactly how does the SWR and power trade off with a balun? Back to net.
Don, good question, John. I think there's a lot of different ways of looking at this. If I quadruple power I'm putting through a balun, or quadruple the power I'm putting through a transformer, in either case, I am doubling the voltage. So double the voltage is quadruple the power. And if you were pushing your luck, you're going to get quadruple the saturation. If I'm operating the balun at the right power level, but I'm running a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, does 2-to-1 double the voltage? No. It's a 50% increase and a 50% decrease, and the ratio is 2-to-1. I'm going to have to work out the mathematics of that, but I think a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio is again doubling the voltage. I'll have to double-check that one. But there is a relationship. We can eventually figure out the mathematics of this. As far as the ferrite itself is concerned, you could say for a fixed frequency whether or not the ferrite saturates is only proportional to the number of volts you're putting across that winding on the ferrite at that frequency. And now, how do you, let me drop. You can develop that voltage by going to a certain power. You can develop that voltage by going to a certain power at a certain standing wave ratio. We don't have the mathematics exact yet. We're going to derive that one. But as you can tell, raising the standing wave ratio raises the voltage put across the balun. Raising the power raises the voltage put across the balun. And the worst combination, of course, is going too high in power and too high in standing wave ratio. You're going to get in trouble four times as fast. So if you had an ideal voltmeter and you put it across the winding on a piece of ferrite, and if at the operating frequency you didn't, if at the rated frequency you didn't exceed that voltage, you would not be saturating it, and in theory it'll run cold. That's not the whole story, but I think it's 80% of the story, John. W82VDH, K2RIW.
Yeah, fine business, Vicky. I was wondering if you could relate that by the reflection coefficient. If you converted SWR to a reflection coefficient and get the total voltage, would that give you the relationship or something like the relationship you would need for seeing if saturation occurred? Go ahead.
I think the answer is yes. What you're talking about in scattering parameters with a network analyzer is called the S11 voltage reflection coefficient. And so if the voltage that is reflected through the transmission line of interest hits a maximum of voltage at your particular balun, then you're in trouble. But the way standing wave ratio works, if I walk along a transmission line that has a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, that's exactly what you're doing with a so-called slotted line. Let me drop. In the old-fashioned days, we used to measure this well with a slotted line. And you had this probe that went down the slot and went near the center conductor of, let's say, the coax cable going down the center of the slotted line. And you slid this probe toward the load or toward the source. You found the peak voltage, and you set your meter at full deflection. And then you went to the place where you found the valley in voltage, and you look at the ratio of those voltages. So, without a doubt, along your transmission line, there are places where the voltage is maximum, there are places where the voltage is minimum. So standing wave ratio alone does not give you the whole answer. If I took your balun that saturated at 100 watts and 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and if I changed the length of the transmission line so that the voltage minimum hit your balun instead of the voltage maximum, there is a chance that with the exact same power and the exact same visuar, I am no longer saturating your particular balun. That's on the assumption that it's voltage sensitive. There are other kinds of balans that are current sensitive, but I'm talking about a voltage sensitive balun. So it's not only a function of what is the power, what is the visuar, how many wavelengths is it away from that load, and what is the load? Am I at the voltage max or the voltage minimum point on that transmission line? Is that where I'm putting the balun? Life ain't simple, is it, John? W82VDH, K2RIW.
I see your point. Okay, yeah, this is a very interesting subject. Okay, I'm going to turn it back to you, Dick. I do have Jerry Cervick's book, Transmission Line Transformers, somewhere around here. Maybe it's at my office. I'm going to be digging into that. Very interesting subject. I'll turn it back to you, Dick. Again, thank you for your help, and thanks for the comments.
Hey, Mel, we've got another almost satisfied customer. He's in Roosevelt. We're going to have to send him a bill. We're having some fun with you, John. So I wonder if any of the guys you've been talking to, Mel, have realized that whether or not you're burning up the balun is also a function of what's the nature of the load, how many wavelengths of transmission line, and are you mounting the balun at the voltage maximum or the voltage minimum on that transmission line for that particular standing wave ratio? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Well, I was going to take this step by step, but we keep getting off the beaten path here a little bit and getting lost again, because this is part of what I was going to allude to. I was not going to get into the controversy or the design of what Ruth Ross did or Granella did or what Jerry Civic did and all. Not, this is not the intent at this point. I could make some comments. I don't know if we should on that right now, of talking about like transmission lines and what they see as far as below the characteristics of the impedance of CO and the relationship of RL and the divided by 3 for the optimum value on these type of Balaam designs. I think we'll work our way past, you know, right, stay away from that right now, Dick, because I think it's going to be too hard for people to grasp. There's a lot more to this than that. I was basically going to try to start base B almost now back at the beginning, Dick, over.
Yeah, anybody listening to this conversation of ours, and quite possibly this is going to be one of those separate packages that'll be on the amateurradio.tv, this is not the whole answer. Balans are a complicated subject. Modern-day transistorized amplifiers quite often have, and the high-power ones, an input impedance like 1 ohm resistive and 4 ohms inductive reactance on the input end, and the output end, the collector end of the transistor, might be 2 ohms resistor and half an ohm of capacitance. And you design the right kind of impedance matching balun and impedance matching strip line structures, and the combination of those that are the input circuit and the output circuit of modern day high power transistorized solid state amplifiers, and you look at those things and you'll say to yourself, what in the world is going on? On many of these high power transistors, the manufacturer will give you a recommended circuit. And if you decide to analyze what's going on that circuit, the input balun, the output balun, and the impedance matching network, you could spend half of a semester studying that to really understand what's going on and how that manufacturer did it. And those baluns on those transistorized amplifiers are highly required, and that manufacturer is trying very darn hard. He's trying very hard to make the transmission impedance have 95% or higher efficiency. He's trying very hard to do that. He doesn't want the balancing structure and the impedance matching structure to get hot. So there's a lot more to it. What Mel and I are giving you tonight is scratching the surface. You haven't heard the whole story. Even if we left Mel alone and didn't keep diverting him on the course that he was taking to teach you balance, it would not be the whole story, because this is as deep as you can get into transmission line theory and impedance matching and isolation circuits as far as balance and unbalance is concerned. There's a lot to it. We're going to be discussing this more in future weeks. I can see it coming. This one's not going to go away in just one session. We're going to have to take it in stages, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, I just wanted to clear up some of these emails because, they constantly, especially the few times I've fallen into this trap on 75 meters to answer the question of why the failure of the so-called kilowatt tuners, especially these, how they make them compact. Now, everybody wants everything compacted. You know, the day of what I have here, the big boxes sitting there, such as the Johnson kilowatt matchbox that's 19 inches wide and 19 inches deep and 19 inches tall, you know, with humongous components in there, is gone. So why did these compact jobs fail? And I start to explain to them, but. So I says, well, that's why I'm going to pick up. I'd rather than try to explain it and get, get all kinds of comments that I'm not on the right track, I figured that's why I'd bring it up here on the TechNet. And so basically, I was going to start really in another way. I wanted to answer these questions, basically, what is happening, you know, why and where are balance and why one works and one doesn't work and what happens. So I think that's what I tried to cover initially, Dick. Let me let it drop for a second. Okay. Basically, going back to why a balance, maybe we should have even started there. In the last, you know, decades, you know, balance weren't around until really, I guess the 40s started, late 30s to 40s when coax started coming into being. And it was accentuated that more balance and all were heard of more after World War II, especially with the coming eventually of solid-state transceivers, and especially linear amplifiers, especially if they're running, you know, and Class B amplifiers, so that we had this unbalanced output situation where the voltage at the center of the, you know, connector in the back of the radio and the chassis, it varies. The voltage varies in respect to the chassis, plus and minus. So this is what we call the voltage variation between the center and ground. Actually, we'll consider the outer ring, as we've been talking, as our ground. So now the that everybody sort of has jumped into use of transmission lines such as coax, and now all of a sudden there seems to be a resurrection of this business of using dipoles, inverted beams, Yagi beams, and everything, which favor actually balance feed. See, this is one thing, even a Yagi actually favors balance feed. So the necessity of using a balun is there. People don't realize that you have a balun on your Yagi. Dick, that's what I'm trying to get over. Get to the next situation, over.
And you're absolutely right. That driven element of every Yagi, in many cases, has some form of balancing device, because our favorite kind of transmission line in the 21st century is coax cable. In 1940 and 1950, many of the antenna designs, like you take, for instance, the W8JK antenna, the John Krause Lazy H or whatever it was fed with open wire line within the middle of the antenna, as well as the transmission line going up the antenna. In those cases, with open wire line everywhere within the antenna and the transmission line going to it, essentially no balun was required. But coax became popular for a bunch of reasons. Let me drop. And that is twin lead to open wire line. To really use it correctly, you don't put it flat against any metallic surface. Even if you put dielectric materials near it, you control the amount of dielectric material because that will change the impedance. You don't make sharp bends. You try to keep the ice and water off of it. To suspend an open wire line, to properly mechanically support it so that it's not waving in the wind and giving you mechanical failure, fatigue failure, to try to properly bring it through the wall of a house to get it into the shack, and not make any sharp bends, and not put it near metal and whatever, to obey all the rules is kind of difficult. You take modern-day coaxial cable, you can bend it any old way you want, you can lay it against metal, you can put it through holes in the wall, you can tuck it under the rug, you can do everything except putting a staple through it, you can put a staple on the outside of it. It gives you a hell of a lot of freedom, and it's a basically shielded structure. That's the good news. The bad news is it's an unbalanced structure. In theory, all the RF energy is on that semiconductor, and between that semiconductor and the inner surface of the outer conductor only. Only the inner surface of the outer conductor. And many a person has got, let me drop, a lot of trouble seeing how you can have RF energy on the inside of a waveguide, but none on the outside, or you can have RF energy on the inner surface of the outer braid, but in theory, no RF energy on the outer surface of the RF braid. And the RF braid is made out of, let me pick a number, strands of 35-gauge wire. How can that round strand of 35-gauge wire have all the RF energy on the inner half of that silly little piece of wire, the inner 180 degrees of it, and no RF energy on the outer 180 degrees of that one particular strand of the blade that I'm studying? How in the world can the RF do that? And that's a bit of a mystery. You'll have to accept it at first. So coax cable has got this magic that it'll survive a whole lot of abuse that you used to do to open wireline. That's the good news, and it's shielded. The bad news is it's got a little bit more loss. It is weatherproof, that's good news. But the fact that it's unbalanced forces you to use balancing structures when you feed the driven element of a coax, of a Yagi, when you feed the center of your dipole. That's if you want to be a purist. If you don't want RF energy flowing down the outside of that cable as a result of your particular antenna, you've got to use some kind of a balancing structure. Now, life gets even more complicated when you take a look at the WA5VJB type Yagis, where he appears to be feeding only one half of the driven element of the dipole, and the other half is sitting there as what looks like a parasitic element. And how in the world does that antenna behave correctly? That antenna is different enough from previous Yagis that he's got a patent on it. That's another whole story. How can you feed only the right-hand side of the driven element of a Yagi, and the left-hand side is undriven, and yet in the operation of the Yagi, it acts driven? That's another subject for another day. But suffice to say, there's a lot more to balance than you've heard tonight. We've just scratched the surface. We're going to have to do some more discussion. I see it coming. K2KEY, K2RIW.
You just raised the point. This is K2KEY, and I better touch upon it because I will get questions. What Dick was just talking about, we started talking about a Yagi bean. Let's stick with the so-called well-known Yagi beans that are around. The a well-designed regular Yagi bean has usually a one-to-one balun in many cases. Most Yagi beans will be, let's say, of a shunt feeding type of design. Many use what is known as a hairpin matching network, and this is basically to raise the impedance to get to as close to 50 ohms. The center of the dipole on this Yagi beam, of the driven element, okay, let's call it the driven element. I think that'd be easier to remember. The driven element of the center of this Yagi beam is actually grounded so that, that the outer braid, we could say, is actually connected to this point, somewhat at this point. So a imbalance actually occurs. So there is the need, because of this type of basic design, the need for this balance. Because you see what's happening here. We're trying to distribute both these halves with the same energy. I better not go any further about certain other designs where they use step-down balance because they eliminate the matching network, prevent that matching network and use a step-down balancing, but I think I'm losing the correct wording, Dick. Maybe you can sort of, explain better the driven element situation. Over.
Yeah, I'm going to try. There are some Yagi designs where the driven element has a half-wave dipole is close to a 50-ohm load. Not many Yagi designs fall that way. The majority of high-performance Yagis, the driven element becomes a 20-ohm dipole. The dipole in free space would be 70 ohms, but when it's in the middle of that Yagi structure, it's 20 ohms. But let me go one step at a time. Let's choose that slightly rare Yagi design where the driven element as a half-wave dipole is 50 ohms. In that particular case, you've got a very nice, simple arrangement. Stand by a minute. I could take the coax cable that feeds that center dipole. I could insulate the dipole from the boom. I've got the right-hand side, the left-hand side, and a notch in the middle, so to speak. I could take the coax cable, take the center conductor, connect it to one half of that dipole, connect the shield to the other half of the dipole. As far as the dipole is concerned, 50-ohm cable, 50-ohm dipole feeding it, everything's hunky-dory, except, as I told you earlier, in many cases, in most cases, you think you've got a 70-ohm or a 50-ohm dipole. It really is 25 ohms to ground on the right-hand side, 25 ohms to ground on the left-hand side, and don't ask me where that ground is. It's somewhere in free space. It's not necessarily the boom. And I'm feeding it with a piece of coax cable. And because that dipole is itself a symmetric structure and is trying to force the voltage to be symmetric, even though it is an unbalanced transmission line feeding it, let me drop, it will, by definition, the dipole itself, after the energy gets onto that dipole, it will reflect energy back into that transmission line on the outside of the shield of that transmission line. You can accept the fact that that's going to happen. And there's a reasonably simple solution. The poor man's coaxial balance. Take three or four turns of that coax cable in a coil close to that driven element, tape it together. Those three or four turns constitutes an RF choke, which is only effective on the outside of the coax cable. The RF energy flowing down the inside, the fact that it's going around those four turns, it doesn't know that. All it knows is there's a couple of extra feet of coax cable somewhere. It doesn't see the turn, the center conductor. But the shield does. By making those turns and taping it together, you've created an RF choke. You have launched some current on the outside of the cable. It goes 6 inches down that cable toward the transmission, sees those four turns, the RF choke, and stops. The RF choke is a high impedance, and only a couple of percent of the RF energy will get through that choke and continue flowing down the outside of the coax cable into the shack. Properly done, that poor man's balance. A few turns of coax cable taped together, and maybe those turns are, let me pick a number, 8 or 10 inches in diameter. That can work like a charm. That particular kind of balance does 98% of what you want to do. Choose the right kind of coax cable, and you can put 2,000 watts into that balance, and it will never get hot. That balance is destructionless. You can't generate enough power to destroy that particular balance. And the next transmission, I'll tell you what you do with that 20-ohm antenna in a similar situation. But that's one possible way of what looks like an unbalanced feed to the dipole, but it becomes a balanced feed because of that poor man's balance of multiple turns. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Okay. I have another question here that I'm going to answer. I just noticed it. My friend said if you hang a dipole up there, cut for that band, and you bring the coax feed off at perpendicular to the dipole, that you don't need a balance. You know, this another one has been thrown around. Why? What does the balance do in this case? Well, all I can tell you that in experiments, now, you can confirm these experiments because I know that the experiments that were done some years ago, I remember reading about them as in an anechoic chamber where they simulated so-called free space. And there was that question, I remember reading that really in detail. The question showed up, what happens with a balloon? What happens without a balloon? And the answer was that with the balloon, you get a classic, so-called classic figure eight pattern on the dipole. And without the balloon, you will get a pattern that is basically a distorted pattern for a dipole. Can you confirm this, Dick, yes or no?
Absolutely, and I've seen it. I've seen the anechoic chamber measurement exactly like you're describing, Mel. If I bring the coax cable straight to the center of a real half-wave dipole, and the dipole could be the kind of electromagnetic interference dipole, which is kind of a birdcage and it's very fat, or it can be a skinny wire dipole like your 80-meter dipole made out of 14-gauge house wire. Doesn't matter. Any of those dipoles fed directly with a piece of coax cable and no balloon will have current flowing down the outside of the cable caused by the antenna itself, the dipole, and now you're radiating from the dipole and you're radiating from the coax cable. And those compound radiations from those two separate structures get added together in free space by the law of superposition, and you get a much more complicated antenna pattern. And you can change that antenna pattern by just changing the length of the transmission line, because it's part of the radiator. Under any normal circumstances where you've got a properly fed antenna, the pattern of the antenna is due to 100% of the antenna only, and the length of the transmission line doesn't matter. But without the proper kind of a balloning structure where your transmission line is part of the radiator, now you're transmission line sensitive and you're going to get a much more complicated sort of lopsided pattern with other lobes in other places. And again, let me drop. It's because you think that dipole is a free floating object in free space. Well, you think so. And your eye thinks that's what you're looking at. Mother Nature's got a few tricks up her sleeve. As far as she's concerned, that symmetric looking dipole with, you think, 70 ohms of impedance in the center, is the right-hand side with 35 ohms to ground, and the left-hand side is another 35 ohms to ground. That grounding characteristic where you could make a simulated dipole on a great big sheet of copper by literally taking a 35-ohm Allen Bradley resistor on the right-hand side and soldering one lead to ground and one lead to the coax cable, and another 35-ohm Allen Bradley resistor on the left-hand side of the dipole, so to speak, the outer end of that resistor grounded to the sheet of copper, and now the two resistors where they come together in the center is where you feed your transmission line. You make a simulated dipole like that, and you'll immediately see why RF energy starts flowing down the transmission line. You take that simulated dipole of those pair of 35-ohm Allen Bradley resistors, and you throw that structure away and put your real dipole there, the amount of RF energy flowing down the outside of your coax cable will be almost the same. At the resonant frequency, that dipole acts like a pair of 35-ohm resistors to ground. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but 80% of what I'm saying, you do the experiment, you'll see that happen. So it's not as free a floating structure as you think it is. And without this balloning device that acts like a one-to-one isolation transformer, without using some kind of a balloning device, the current flowing on the cable will complicate your pattern, and in some cases it will complicate your life. It's not going to make things burn up. It's not going to be the end of the world, but it's a less than ideal antenna. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right. What I'll do next week, we'll get into a little bit different discussion on this, because I see this is, like you say, first time you hear it, you're going to go bonkers. So what we'll do, I think next week, we'll give you, I'll give you a diagram. I'm picturing a actual how I presented it once in front of class by actually a how the display or illustration of the various currents at the feet points of a dipole by just using a piece of coax without, in other words, without a balun, what actually takes place. Maybe that will be more of a an illustration of, you know, just illustrating currents as I1 and I2 in a situation with a piece of cable. But the balun, as Dick was just basically, maybe I can say a few more words on it. Grinnella worked back in the late 40s, or yeah, about mid-40s. He first started out, as Dick just said, he coiled transmission lines, and it formed this choke, which really was the basis of, you know, the control of the line current. He coiled the transmission lines, resulting in what we were just talking about as a one-to-one balance. But he basically was, previous to that, showing that the use of quarter wave and halfway pieces of transmission line had similar results, but much narrower results. So what am I actually bringing up? That with the modern balun that you can get, you will find that you have better so-called bandwidth than the system that he originally showed that. In fact, I showed on a Smith chart you can do certain things similar to this. Let me let it drop. So that you can demonstrate, this was the demonstration basically, that the broadband balun and impedance transformations from 1 to, as he called it, to Grinnella called it, he called it 1 to n squared, where the number, where N is the number of transmission lines he connected in series and parallel arrangements to achieve this. So this is the result. I'm just trying to show you the background of the experiment of how balun came along. This basically was the original balun, as Dick just said, just a coil of the transmission line. He coiled it up and he formed his first one-to-one balun, whereas previously he was doing it with length of transmission line, but couldn't achieve the bandwidth. So I think we'll leave it maybe at that point, because getting into a little bit more of a subject, Dick, I think it's going to take a little bit more in depth than we have time over.
Dumbin.
Wesley recognized. If you have enough turns of that balun, that poor man's balun, a coax cable coiled, taped together, acting as an RF choke, properly done, that can be a good one-to-one balun, probably from 80 through 10 meters. That can be very broadband. There are ways of putting together combinations of things like that, but they're going to be bulky. That balun I just described, made out of RG8, is probably going to be 10 inches diameter and 3, 4, 5 turns to do it right. Maybe even more turns to get down to 80 meters or 160. The nice thing about these ferrite structures is you can take that down to a small fraction of the volume, but if you're not careful, you run into saturation characteristics and frequency bandwidth limiting characteristics. There's a lot more to the subject. When it comes to the design of a simple 60-cycle, 120-volt primary power transformer, if I took all of the electrical engineers coming out of the best schools in the United States with a bachelor degree, and I told them what is the saturating flux of my particular kind of iron, and I told them how many square inches or square centimeters is the cross-sectional area of the iron, and if I told them I want them to design for me a 100-watt transformer and just design the primary winding alone, don't even talk about the secondary winding and the voltage ratio, just to properly set up the right diameter of wire and the right turns ratio for the primary winding on that transformer. If I took all of the electronic engineers out of the United States, best schools, bachelor degree, just graduating, I'll be amazed if 5% of those students could answer that question. The bottom line is once you get into iron and windings, people go bonkers. They think you're talking Chinese. The way the subject was introduced to them did not stick, did not make sense. They memorized those equations. They spit back the memorizations. They passed the test. They didn't know what the blank they were doing. 5 or 10% of them barely understand that subject. And that's just the beginning of balance. So once you get into iron and windings, with the majority of engineers and even ham radio operators, you're in a fair amount of trouble until you really dig into it. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wesley.
Okay, this is N2XJN. Well, I could say you covered very well the subject, but it's monogamic, like a monogamy. One wife, one problem, and one way to fight with the problem. How about two wives? Is it going to be the tragedy? Well, there is a way of using balloons, you can call them traps, to eliminate chance of unwanted signals entering into the feed lines. And one of the very, very old examples of that is the antenna that is W3DZZ, W3 Delta Zebra Zebra. Google that, and yeah, I would appreciate if you give me some information about it. And to exit.
Okay, when I get a chance, I'll look at that. Thank you for the suggestion.
No. It's just a little bit different way to fight with the problem. There are two traps. You have two pieces of dipole, approximately 10 meters and changed. And then you have, along with the coil, you have a capacitor. And then there is a also important factor, there is a space in the center of the coax on the top of the antenna. It's very easy. It's 10 seconds and you know what I'm talking about.
Okay, I just Googled the word W3DZZ antenna, and my machine is loading up right now. And, boy, he's got a lot of stuff here. So I'm going to have to find which portion of what he's talking about you're referring to right now. Looks like the DX zone, I guess he calls it. I think he's got a whole manufacturing, the W3DZZ antenna feature 11 links. So the first thing Google found for me is 11 links to W3DZZ. Lots of stuff there. I'm going to have to spend some time looking at it. But Mel, I wonder if you have found somewhat like I have. Whenever iron and turns ratios are involved, whether it be balance, transformers, primary windings, whatever, life gets complicated very fast for the vast majority of supposedly experienced engineers. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Actually, this is K2KEY. In fact, you just alluded to a very good factor about building a balance, and I remember reading a very interesting article. In fact, it was by W2FMI, and Jerry, he explained that just the design of the balum and the material, how to go about it, and just slight change in the design will take you from a balun that will take a peak of 500 watts to one that takes a kilowatt. And it doesn't make it doesn't have to be a great deal of change that to create this tremendous difference. And this is the problem, of course, that many manufacturers of these tuners and all, especially, like I say, the bargain tuners, that's what they're doing. And they don't realize that these balans, the way they are designing them, because they're doing things, you know, they're not sticking, let me put it this way, I'll make it simple, they're not sticking to the Grinnella design. They're sticking to a little bit of a difference in the design. So that they will experience with these balans a situation where they're looking for balanced current, but not balanced voltage. There's the thing. Oh, I've got to bring that up. That's a whole other situation where they look at that and they're not realizing that the balanced current is fine, but you're not balancing the voltage. This creates a new problem in this design, and this is, like I say, failures are considerable now with almost everybody you hear on 75 meters have gone over to some other type of design. I won't get into the ones like with the dual rotary and, the homebrew jobs that the Sirius. Let me say one more thing. Let me drop first. Okay, now as far as using the coil method, Dick, I meant to comment on that. If you use an RG8U, you have to make a 10-inch circle with it, 24 turns. So you can see why that has never been a favorable way to go. You can well imagine the size of this balun, even though it would work real well, because I have tried it. It was my so-called way of getting away from that toroidal situation. And as I said, it's very hard to come up with a balun that is going to satisfy all these needs. Going back to something that I'm using, which I don't understand why, but I understand there is a manufacturer, I'm sorry, I should say that, there is a manufacturer now making a tuner for balanced feed that is using the system like I would have in the Johnson Kilowatt Match box as a, using link coupling, Dick, over.
Yeah, once you do everything in air, with inductors in air and capacitors, except for arcing over the capacitors, there is no real saturation. The good news about doing things with ferrites and irons is that you can make things a lot more complex. The bad news is that you've now got to obey some very strict rules about maximum voltage, maximum current, turns ratios, frequencies, and whatever, so that you do not saturate the iron. Iron that saturates behaves in a very undesirable, nonlinear manner and can rapidly start making a lot of heat. And as one of the things that Jerry Civic, W2FMI, brought out, let me drop, there are certain kinds of toroid, ferrite cores that if you overheat them with RF energy and saturation, you can make a permanent change to the ferrite material itself, and it comes up with a brand new permeability rating. So you got to be careful. Not only do you have to worry about burning up your wiring in your core, but you could be permanently damaging the core by what you've done to it. So you got to be careful. And step by step, we'll eventually find out which brand of balun, what power level, what frequency, what standing wave ratio, and where on the transmission line is that particular balun located? Is that a voltage maximum point or a voltage minimum point? Makes a big difference as to whether or not it will burn up. So it's not just a magnitude of VISWAR. You could call it magnitude of VISWAR along with the phase angle. That's what really happens. when you go to the maximum voltage point on a standing wave ratio transmission line, you've got a 0 degree phase difference between the forward signal and the